Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Hello, I'm Kay Thompson. Welcome to Kay Thompson Live here on, I was getting ready to say the radio station I used to work for, but not that. This is Kay Thompson Live. We're on the internet radio, and we're heard all over. As a matter of fact, I understand that we're heard all over the globe. And I had first found out about that when I didn't know anything about the internet through my brother-in-law, Congressman Donald Payne. And I would always get him to give me interviews and him to give me information about what was going on in Congress and his different, travels around the world because of the fact that he was, you know, very much into involved with world issues, being a member of Congress and a very important member of Congress. And so this is what we're striving to do. Well, we started to tell how I found out about being on the internet radio. One night I called him and I said, don't forget we're going to be going on at 8 o'clock and are you ready? And he said, well, let me see, I'm going to be in Somalia, then I have to go to several other places. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, aren't you in Washington? And he said, Kay, are you on the internet? I said, yeah, I think so. And he said, well, you're heard all over the world. And that was about 4 or 5 years ago that I had just found that out. So I was really tickled. And as a matter of fact, I was really scared. I said, yeah, I'm being heard all over the world. And they said, yes, and the people that talk to you, when they call in, they are also heard all over the world. And that's the story of the internet. So welcome, everybody. We are going to be talking about Muhammad Ali and his demise and so many people just devastated because of the fact that he was one of the most famous people in the African-American community. And we have a special, report. Well, not really a report, but Eric is going to be sharing his story about, you know, being involved with and talking to Muhammad Ali. As a matter of fact, he went to his camp, you know, and he's going to be telling you about that experience. That's very exciting. Anyway, as you all know, Muhammad Ali was so great. I used to watch his fights. My father watched his fights. I mean, just about everybody did. And it has really taken, the whole country, as a matter of fact. Not surprisingly, because he was ill. But the point is, you know, the death of such a great, great, great person, you know, it's really not shocking, but sad. And he was ill for a long period of time, and we were able to have him with us for that period of time, and he made us all feel very good, his fights and his antics during the time that he was fighting, and he was just a fantastic person. And Eric and I know you have a story to tell about Muhammad Ali, so shall we get right to that, because I've been telling people that you're going to be telling them about that.
How you doing, everybody, on this Wednesday evening? We're going to let Wayne Gilman have just called on the line. Hey, Wayne, how are you?
All right, Eric, Kay, how's everyone?
All right, we're doing okay. How are you today, this evening?
Just fine. I'm glad about the results yesterday there in Jersey, California, and across the country. I think the momentum is now changing in the direction it should be politically.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. But Wayne, you know what we want to do? I want to talk about Muhammad Ali first, and then
okay,
do the whole political
right
thing, because that was so important. And you being over there at LIB during a certain point of that time, and with all that information going out about him, and everybody was always, you know, riveted to anything Ali did, and he was the greatest. So that's what we want to talk about. So we want to talk about our memories. And Eric had a personal visit with Muhammad Ali that I want him to tell people about. Eric?
Yeah, like I was getting ready to say, the passing of Muhammad Ali is extremely devastating for everybody that was aware of him. Obviously, the most famous human being on the planet, that was Muhammad Ali at the height of his popularity, and he never ceased to be that person. Everybody knew Muhammad Ali, and only people who didn't know him were young people who were new to the world, but I think that if they were Americans, they eventually knew who he was. I'm speaking of people, young people that might have been in foreign countries who didn't live in the land of his birth. But for me, Muhammad Ali was a childhood hero. I was fortunate enough to have heroes in my household, my mother and my father and other family members. But Muhammad Ali, and, you know, I had the basics, Batman at the time and other TV people. But for me, Muhammad Ali became a childhood hero at a very pivotal time in my life. It was after my family moved out of Newark after the uprising in the 68, also known as the Newark riots. And we moved to Maplewood, and that's around the time I became aware of Muhammad Ali, is when his comeback against Joe Frazier. I was vaguely familiar with him. I was just becoming familiar with him because he was in the news, and I remember sitting there watching TV with my mom when he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show with the Broadway show that he was in, because I remember having this beard and this big afro, and I saw a clip from that the other day, and a clip said that it was from this play that he was doing on Broadway. So I thought it was because it was locked up, but he never actually got locked up for being a conscientious objector. But I thought that's what happened at the time. So around my fifth grade year, first year in school in Maplewood, New Jersey, I remember seeing these white kids walk around linked arm in arm, a group of white boys. They were chanting, "Clay, Clay, Clay." And this is before I actually started liking Muhammad Ali, because I thought he was a braggart, and I didn't like someone who bragged a lot and all of that. And I had in my mind this kind of imaginary little rascal-ish confrontation with these kids. If I had some other kids with me, I would have walked up to them and said, "You want clay, do you? Well, here," and mushed the clay in their face. But that was my fantasy in my mind. Of course, it never happened. But as time went on, you know, Muhammad Ali went on to lose that fight, as we all know, and I kind of like told you. But then I started to pay attention to Muhammad Ali and the things that he was saying and doing, and I liked the fact that he started knocking people out. After that, I mean, after Joe, he came back and fought a bunch of fights, worked his way up, and there was I'm sure you remember this, Wayne. post his being stripped of his title, before that, when Muhammad Ali was fighting, he was knocking cats out. When he predicted a ring, a round that they were getting knocked out him, they were going down. And then there was a time period after he got stripped of his, when he made his comeback, where he was doing that at the same, he was doing that also. He was saying, so-and-so is going down, made up a rhyme, so-and-so is going down in the fifth round, that person was going down. And what really struck me as one of the few black people in this environment, and that Muhammad Ali gave me a sense of pride, and I was able to find confidence in myself just by his manner. And Muhammad Ali, became my idol because he started talking this trash, but also you could see that he was standing up for black people, and I learned why they stripped him of his title, and also the fact that he was in the Nation of Islam. A lot of white people obviously didn't like that, because the Nation of Islam had some very extreme views, but for black people, and no offense to our white friends, but for a lot of black people, we knew that endeared Muhammad Ali to us even more, because we knew. And he said it, that he was always going to be beholden to his people. And you understood that he was going to be beholden to the liberation of his people. And not in a way that would denigrate white people, but he was pro his own people. And he understood the position that black people obviously are in this country. And as he transitioned and further developed, he left the Nation of Islam and practiced more orthodox Muslim, and became a more orthodox Muslim. But for me, as a young black kid that was in a mostly white environment, who wore orthopedic shoes, who wasn't cool, when I went back to the hood, I talked like a white boy, I was told. When I was here living in Maplewood, I was black. So Muhammad Ali gave me that confidence, you know, just following him and trying to be like him and watching him in his fights talk, because you never got this sense to me, at least anyway, that Muhammad Ali really meant what he said. He always talked this trash in a joking manner, in an entertaining manner, probably to everybody but the other fighters and grown men that he was talking to. And as I look at it now, as a man, if I was a grown man and this kid came talking to me like that, you know, I would want to knock him out too. The only thing is, as Muhammad Ali said, it ain't bragging if you could back it up. So and he was more than willing to back it up anytime, anywhere. And beyond his ability as a fighter, Muhammad Ali, very rarely do we find someone that's willing to give up everything, all the material things, because of his integrity and his spiritual beliefs. And this was before all of the internet and the social media and all that. Muhammad Ali was the most famous man on the planet, and he gave it all up. He gave it all up, and he stood by his principles. And you're not going to find that in anybody, and very few people will you find that in, to find that trait in. And certainly very few athletes nowadays, very few people who are celebrities nowadays are not going to give up everything because of what they believe. And Muhammad Ali did that. And he spoke loud and clear about the issues and the plights of black people. And he was very nice. But if you started questioning about that, I mean, there's hundreds of videos on YouTube where white people, well-intentioned and respectfully, challenge him on his views. And he goes at them and he lets them know, what his thoughts of the day. So, I mean, there's also a footage of Muhammad Ali saving a man's life. He was going to jump off of a building in California. A man had climbed out on the balcony. And Muhammad Ali, this is in Los Angeles, the guy was yelling to people, "I have nothing to live for, my life is this." And Muhammad Ali happened to be driving by with his crew. Saw the crowd, found out what was going on, ran up there to the floor, stuck his head out the next window, was talking to the guy, said, "I'm your brother, come down, talk to me." Muhammad Ali talked this guy off the ledge and saved his life. That's who Muhammad Ali was. So, you know, he was the greatest fighter of all time, in my estimation. You know, if you look at the boxing ranks now, they're nothing. And the level of heavyweights that he had to fight, you could see that those were some great heavyweights during that time period. I'm sure you could attest to that, Wayne. But Muhammad Ali was the man. So the story is that when I met Muhammad Ali, my uncle was running for Congress, one of the first times he ran for Congress against the late, great Peter Rodino. And one of my uncle's students was a bodyguard for Muhammad Ali, one of my uncle's former students. He arranged with another one of his frat brothers, with a frat that my uncle founded, to get the gang kids from being in gangs and try to get them to have positive activities. So he developed these fraternities like the colleges had. So these guys were frat brothers, and they arranged for us to come down there and talk to Muhammad Ali, try to convince him to come to Newark and make an appearance for my uncle. So we go to Deer Lake, which is Muhammad Ali's training camp, and he was sitting up on a rock. You know, they said Muhammad Ali liked to entertain people doing magic tricks, and we saw him through the trees. I was looking for my idol, saw him through the trees sitting up there, and then he came down and met us and shook our hands. And you know, when you meet your childhood hero, you know, there's something really remarkable about that. You're kind of in awe, which I was in awe of Muhammad Ali. And I was struck by how big he was and how, you know, you never realize until you meet somebody in real life the physicality of them and how long. They always talked about his reach. His arms did seem to be kind of long, you know, to me. But he was a big, solid guy. I shook his hand and everything, yeah. And
I tell you, his hands were enormous, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and he just was in shape. I mean, this guy, I guess he was in his 30s at the time, mid to late 30s, and he was in shape. And we went into the mess hall, and everybody was sitting down trying to talk to Muhammad Ali, and he started going for it a little bit. He was like, "Yeah, maybe I could come and make up this rhyme or that," and he started talking, and he was open to the idea. Then all of a sudden he got a phone call, and someone said, "Hey, Champ, telephone for you." And the telephone was at the other end of the mess hall, which was right behind where I was sitting. So Muhammad Ali got on the phone, and whoever was talking to him, was talking to him for a while. But I noticed that, after a minute, people started laughing in the room, you know. And I thought I heard a fly or something flying around near my ear. And I kind of looked around, you know, and I turned back, and I didn't think anything. Muhammad Ali was on the phone, so I didn't think anything of it. And then I heard the noise again. And then somebody came over with a newspaper that was there with it. It was like, Where'd that fly go? So then I realized that Muhammad Ali was reaching with his long reach, was reaching over near my ear, making this little noise when he would rub his fingers together and make this noise with his thumb and an index finger. And at first I didn't think he could do it because he was standing so far away, like 2 feet away from me. But all he had to do with his reach was just turn around, reach next to my ear, make this noise with his hands, and then turn back over to the phone. It was remarkable. I was tempted to talk some trash to him, but, you know, that was the champ. So I kind of chickened out a little bit. And at the end, hold on 1 second, Ma. At the end, they took a picture of myself with Muhammad Ali reaching over near me, which is on my Facebook page. Anybody interested, Citizen Payne on Facebook. But you have in the picture, you see Muhammad Ali standing there, reaching over with his hand next to my ear, making this noise, and I'm sitting there with my head in my hand, my head leaning on my hand there. And it's fortunately I have the picture now. Go ahead, Ma.
The reason why I'm trying to get your attention, Eric, is because of the fact that you need to tell people how old you were at that time.
Okay.
You know, because you were very young and you were very impressed.
Right.
So that was very important.
Right. I was 19 at the time, 18 or 19 at the time. And it was right before he fought Leon Spinks. And the thing was that when Muhammad Ali got off the phone, he was like, hey, let's get out of here, you guys. These guys want to eat, talking about all this, his sparring partners, and everybody wanted to eat their lunch. So he took us in a little trailer that was his, and we sat up in there talking to him. The white guy that was with us, my father's business partner, Ed Russo, had to wait outside the trailer. Muhammad Ali said, you know, I'm not going to be able to do it. What happened was those guys had convinced him not to break training camp to go and do this political thing. And it was not too long after, a few years before, when Jimmy Carter had sent Muhammad Ali over to Africa to meet with some heads of state. There was some issue going on, and it backfired on Muhammad Ali because these guys were heads of state. And they were like, we like Muhammad Ali. And Wayne, you could probably, Mom, you guys might remember this better than I do. They liked Muhammad Ali, but he wasn't head of a state, and they took it as a slight by Jimmy Carter, and kind of Muhammad Ali caught a little flack for that. So he was reluctant to get back into politics to do something that was directly involved in politics. But that was that's my Muhammad Ali story that I always cherish. I mean, we went a couple of times to closed circuit TV, went to see him in Ken Norton fight. When Ken Norton should have won that fight, but they gave it to Muhammad Ali, but we didn't care because we loved him so. So, you know, that was he was really a great guy. I cried, you know, when I heard that he died because it was always Muhammad Ali. I would have these Muhammad Ali moments. That's a time for a Muhammad Ali moment and just, you know, his sayings and everything. So to this day, I look at his stuff on YouTube and watch the videos of him. And he'll be surely missed because he was really one of the greatest individuals that this planet will ever see. I don't know if you have a Muhammad Ali story, Wayne.
To be honest with you, I'm ashamed to say that I'm a little older than you are, so I remember a little more than perhaps what you might have even appreciated, even if you were my age. And the thing is that... you know, I remember you talked about the whole business with him being involved in the Nation of Islam and the controversy with that. And I distinctly remember the confusion because we had just lost on the precipice of losing Malcolm X around that particular time. And I wasn't even in media then. I didn't get into the media until 1971, 72. And the thing is that I knew the reverence and respect that that both figures had, but I also found out in my early development in media, and particularly working for Inner City, which was under black ownership at that time, you know, the I guess the divisions and the problems between Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, Minister Louis Farrakhan, and what Ali's involvement in the Nation meant to sort of like clean the image of what Elijah Muhammad was trying to do, you know, because it's no secret, it's been documented that the Nation did have some involvement with the killing of Malcolm, and Malcolm... Muhammad, after a number of years, decided to segue into completely different, more orthodox, as you pointed out, level of Islam. But, you know, when you stop and look at what he did politically for us as people, he said things that many of the greats prior to his rise in the boxing arena would, you know, the only other person I could think of would be Jackie Robinson, who, you know, basically echoed the same thoughts, went through the same, and in many instances, Robinson went through far worse degradation than Ali, because at least Ali was able to back up what he was doing, and I think it was a question of confidence. Robinson, although was confident about his level of play, he wasn't as consistent as Ali as an athlete. But as an orator, as a political figure, you know, those guys were giants. And, you know, each generation takes it a step further. Robinson was 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Ali came to rise in the late 1950s. They keep making this reference to, and I don't even know this, I used to follow wrestling back in the day, but I don't know this guy, white guy, Gorgeous George, that they say he got his bit from. But regardless of whoever was responsible
for
Ali's, I don't know if you heard that, but I mean, they keep making a reference, oh, Muhammad this, Muhammad that, and all that stuff, that he stole his act. You know, I don't think anything is original out here, but whatever Ali did after, fact, he replicated whatever this guy was doing at the time. He took it to a level that no one else had ever expected. And I am so glad to see, you know, I mean, it bothered me to hear, but I knew this man was suffering for 30 plus years with this Parkinson's. It did bother me to hear that he lost his fight, but, you know, he had been in and out the hospital. It was almost like, you know, losing my dad. You know, I just thought he would get past this round in the hospital again. You know, I was shocked to wake up Friday or Saturday morning, whatever it was, and got the news that he had passed, you know, overnight. But remarkable individual. I only had a chance to meet him and his then-girlfriend, current wife, now I didn't know the first wife, at a White House dinner around the time Jimmy Carter was president. And the same thing that you said about his tremendous physique, and I just remember him shaking my hands, and I felt like I had a child's hand when he shook my hand. And as for his wife, I mean, I had the same vision as I had of your mother when I met her, Eric. You know, I had never seen such a beautiful black woman in all my life. You know? Hi, Kay. Anyway, so
yeah, make sure you mention people that I'm not white.
No.
I know you're not talking about me, but you know, some people may say, you know, da 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 da. But anyway,
yeah,
you know, he was really a great man. I got interested in watching boxing because of the courage that he exhibited in standing up to the white community. Okay.
Yeah.
He did not care. He did not care. And he would say anything and dare you to say anything back, because he was very clever, very witty, you know. And I was so surprised. The reason why I watched him boxing was, I think, because of him and because my father always watched a lot of boxing, you know. And but I don't remember the people that he was watching at that age because I was very young. But at the same time, I always found him fascinating because he said exactly what he wanted to, and he did what he wanted to, and plus he was poetic as he did it. In other words, punch you out and then talk nicely about you in a poem or something. But I thought he was absolutely hilarious. So I became really interested in boxing at that particular point with Muhammad Ali when he came into being. So
he did a lot for the fight game. I mean, the deal is that it was already at its peak after Joe Louis and Sugar Ray and all that. But, you know, Ali took it to a completely different level that by the time he retired, you know, it was difficult. There was talking about boxing going down. You know, no one had ever, amounted to what he was doing in terms of popularity, the endorsements. And, you know, I mean, you could say, I mean, we're still out and, you know, we don't know. I mean, of course, the impact of him being beaten, you know, after he had returned to the ring after being stripped of his title at the height of his career had a tremendous impact. you know, on his ability to have a quality life after that. But, you know, at the same time, his media nemesis or friendly media nemesis, Howard Cosell, he also died of Parkinson's disease, and he wasn't in the ring. So you kind of figure, you know, what is with Parkinson's? You know, the actor Michael Fox, you know, it's just interesting. I don't know. I hope they find a cure for it, because after he was silenced by this crippling disease, you know, life was never the same. And, you know, I'm not into, you know, I'm like one of these people who are doggedly optimistic when it comes to certain things, but I knew it would take a miracle for him to come back to even utter the words that he used to say, you know, in his poetic appearances and things like that.
Well, you know what I was doing earlier? I went to YouTube, and I actually watched his fight on YouTube. I think it was the Thrill in Manila of a George Foreman fight.
Right.
And
that was Joe Frazier.
Was Joe Frazier?
Thrill in Manila was Joe Frazier, the last time Joe Frazier fought.
Really? Oh, I thought it was George Foreman.
Rumble in the Jungle was
the Rumble in the Jungle was Foreman.
That was in Zaire. Okay, well, yeah, that was Zaire then. But he, that was fascinating to me, because he obviously, and you know, I didn't generally watch fights so that I knew exactly what was going on. But it was obvious that when he was holding back, and he was making little comments, you know, during the rounds and whatnot, and I got really, really tickled. But at the end, he really, beat Foreman. Terribly.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed that fight. So I would never have been interested in boxing if not for Muhammad Ali. And I think a lot of people will tell you the same thing. Oh, and also I wanted to tell you all that I tried to get in touch with Larry Hazard. You know, Larry Hazard was reappointed by the governor as the boxing commissioner, and he was on with us. And I couldn't get in touch with, you know, Larry, you know, within the last couple of days. But, you know, I'm going to try again, because I know he'll come on again.
Right. Also, you know, you talked about the both of those fights, you know, Ma. As you guys probably know, there's a documentary, The Rumble in the Jungle, the Zaire fight with George Foreman. And it's a whole kind of documentary called When We Were Kings. And it's about, you know, they had the show over there. They put Don King playing a concert. James Brown was there. Bill Withers was there. Mary McKeever performed. I mean, they made a whole thing that weekend. I guess that whole week, maybe, it was a whole thing where people were going over there performing. And you know, the thing about Muhammad Ali Bumbaye, Bumbaye means just kill him. So Ali, kill him. And they said that, you know, because Muhammad Ali was a Muslim and practiced Islam, when you left the United States, even in those days, particularly in African countries and Arab countries, the dominant religion was Islam. So that was something also that endeared him to the rest of the world. And when you see him running through the streets of Zaire with hundreds of crowds of people, you know, when they said, when if you look at the film or look at any pictures, when Muhammad Ali got there, he was met at the airport by thousands of people. You know, people are chasing behind him, Ali, Bumbaye. And when George Foreman came to town, he got off the plane and he had his German shepherds with him. And what someone neglected to tell George Foreman was that the German shepherds were dogs used by the Belgium who had colonized Zaire at the, years before. So this is what I heard or learned along the way. I think I might have seen it in the documentary, actually. That because George had these German shepherds, which were dogs used by the oppressor, you know, it kind of rubbed. He was starting off on the wrong foot, let's say, that culturally with the people. So of course they were with Muhammad Ali, you know, as they talked. And the thing about Muhammad Ali too is that I think that he'll always be relevant to future generations because of his youthful manner. You know, Muhammad Ali, even no matter how old he was, he always seemed like a kid, always playing, always joking. That's why I said, when he was talking trash, to everybody else, it seemed like he was playing, you know, because he would talk this stuff and make fun of these people. But obviously, it was kind of a stand-up comedy routine from a big boxer. Unfortunately, sometimes he went overboard, as he did with Joe Frazier. As we look back at it now,
you know, the way he kind of painted Joe Frazier as the white man's champion and made it seem like Joe wasn't down for the people, which he really was, you know.
And he took it personally, too. I mean, it really hurt him.
And his family, too. I mean, they all, unfortunately, took it very, very personally. And that was, you know, when you, in hindsight, you look back on it, and that was, you know, it wasn't too cool, you know, Molly promoting black pride, so to speak, and here you're talking about one of your brothers as a gorilla. So, you know, even in his mindset, I believe that, you know, he was a product of his time in using that one time. So I think maybe he tried to make it up to Joe, maybe not. But, you know, they had such a difficult relationship, to put it lightly. I mean, I remember watching Wide World of Sports when Howard Cosell was interviewing Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, and you remember this, way, and they couldn't be in the same studio together because they would start fighting. And they started tussling. They started tussling, you know. And Muhammad Ali's brother, Rahman, jumped in. Muhammad Ali, that's when Muhammad Ali and his brother jumped Joe Frazier. On TV.
And that was must see TV back then.
Yeah, can you imagine? On a Saturday afternoon on free TV, you get to see the number one fighter in the world. You remember those days in Wild World Sports? There was no cable TV.
Exactly.
There was no internet. Muhammad Ali was fighting for free on TV. That was the remarkable thing, that you could watch a fight. I remember watching Muhammad Ali fight in the afternoon in Maplewood because the fight was in at whatever time it was, wherever he was fighting. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was really a remarkable time to be able to just turn on the TV and watch the greatest of all time do his thing. And also just to watch him talk in the press conferences he would give. I just recently saw some footage that I hadn't seen of his college speaking tour, where he's talking about people, you know, people should have love for one another. And he really breaks it down. They actually showed it that night on MSNBC when they reported his death, because I took a nap Friday night, woke up, and I happened to check my phone, and I looked on the Instagram website, and a friend of mine had put up a picture of Muhammad Ali, rest in peace. I was like, oh, no, he passed away. But they were showing some footage of this old tape of Muhammad Ali on the college speaking tours. And that's when a lot of these young college students got to know Muhammad Ali and hear his thoughts and things like that. And it was really eye-opening, because he was running it down. I mean, he was preaching a little bit.
And he was ahead of his time. Everything he talked about, he was way ahead of his time. I mean, you know, the war, everybody was against the war. I mean, it's unfortunate. And I'm so glad I saw a piece, and I know I was a youngster when he gave this news conference complaining about the Vietnam War, that he had no problem with the Viet Cong and that those people never bothered him. And, you know, and he talked about the disproportionate number of black folk out there, because I lived through that, going to the war. I had friends that I went to in high school, Bishop Ford in Brooklyn, which is about to close, or I think it's closed now. And I never forget the year before, the senior class guys that I used to hang out with and play ball with in the yard there at the school, they got, because the draft was on then, and if your draft number was high, whether you were accepted to the college or not, and half of us couldn't afford to send our kids to school because of the economic circumstances in our community, and they were on the front lines. I'll never forget, there was one guy I went to school with, God rest his soul. We were playing in Coney Island one weekend. The next day he was in Saigon facing enemy bullets, you know, and he unfortunately never came back. And I'm just saying, you know, I mean, when it got to the point when I was eligible to go, I was, you know, can't even repeat what I was thinking, you know, but at the same time, I guess my timing was right. At that point, Nixon was about to end the war, but I sweated quite a few bullets before that happened, because I saw what was happening to us, and Ali was the only one who talked about the disproportionate number of folk out there who looked like us, and many of those who were able to get deferments or had their political connections, no disrespect to you and your family's history, but the deal is that people, and I wouldn't even say it was a color thing, primarily white politicians who were in a position to save and prevent their kids from serving, they got deferments.
That was way before our family history foray into politics anyway. But, yeah, I mean, you're right. They were getting those deferments and were able to get out of that. And Muhammad Ali was the first one to say it plain. You know, he said, no Viet Cong ever called me an N-word, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and they didn't hear it like that. And they also said that Dr. King felt liberated in terms of his addressing of the Vietnam War because of Muhammad Ali speaking the way he did. I mean, it's unfortunate that him and Malcolm had the falling out that they did because of the nation.
Yeah.
But, you know, Muhammad Ali was out there speaking loud and clear about the issues of black people. I mean, he had no qualms about it, and he didn't mince any words about it. If you asked him, or people are interviewing, he would say up front, you know, what's going on. I've seen clips of him saying to white people, you're the ones I need to fear. You're the ones killing off my people, you know. He runs it down, and he makes it very, very plain. You know, I mean, some of his quotes, I'm just looking at here, one of his quotes, you know, this quote right here, Muhammad Ali is hilarious. Here, one of his quotes is, I done wrestled an alligator. I done tussled with a whale, handcuffed lightning, thrown thunder in jail. Only last week I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean I make medicine sick. You know, I mean, if you just think about that, you know. And some of the other quotes that I've heard attributed to him that I didn't even know were his, you know.
He's been around. I mean, he's had some classics. I guess the one that I remember is Float Like a Butterfly, Sting Like a Bee, Your Hands Can't Hit What Your Eyes Can't See. And that, well, I mean, I just remember that from the time. Huh?
Him and Bundini, Drew Bundini Brown was the guy that was always standing in his corner saying that same thing. Sting like a bee, and they would say, rumble, young man, rumble. And you said the complete quote, your eyes can't hit what your hands can't hit what your eyes can't see.
Exactly.
You know?
And he was just like that. He was like lightning on the, you know, I remember when I saw him for the first time in the ring. It was at Yankee Stadium, and I'm certain, Kay, you remember those days. Black folks, that it was almost like going to church on Easter Sunday. People would dress, you know, fur coats. I remember seeing Walt Clyde Frazier in his floor-length fur. You know, I mean, I felt so bad for the animals the way people were dressed. But they would go to these events like as if it was the second coming of Christ. And, you know, it was just a time that you would have had to live through to appreciate, Eric. And, you know, I was younger then, but, I mean, I was still at the point where I was able to get into certain things, and I was just getting started in media then, and it was at the height of his career. And I just think it's just sad, you know, those 3 to 4 years that the government took out of his fight game, you know, had a tremendous impact, but he was able to come back, but he paid a big price for it in the long run. And it, you know, again, 74 to me is still young. You know, 74 is the new 40 to me. And it's just unfortunate that he had to leave this planet, but such a legacy. And I'm so glad the media has taken time to give the kind of, you know, send off. And I can only imagine what's going to happen the next 2 days, because tomorrow is Thursday. I think the memorial is tomorrow, or the funeral is tomorrow. And then there's the memorial service Friday.
I mean, here's another quote of his that I've heard this quote. I didn't know it was Muhammad Ali that said it. It says, service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was his quote, but
what was that again? Say that
service
question.
To others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth. You know, and it's that type of mentality that he had. I mean, he could say something like that in terms of being others, and then he also said this. He said, I have been so great in boxing They had to create an image like Rocky, a white image on screen to counteract my image in the ring. America has to have its white images no matter where it gets them. Jesus, Wonder Woman, Tarzan, and Rocky.
Mm. Wow.
So, you know, he ran it down a lot of times. I'm trying to find the one where he said, right after he beat Sonny Liston, what he says. He says something like, I'm heavyweight champion of the world. I'm 22 years old, and I'm only 22 years old. I must be the greatest. You know, and it was said that he came up, Muhammad Ali acted that way because he was to control his fear. You know, he started talking trash because he was scared. So to control his fear, that's when he started talking that trash. And it started working, you know, once he got in the ring and loosened up and started, you know, doing his thing. But that's where a lot of that trash talk came from. And then he realized, the word is he realized that got him. Got people's notoriety and people wanting to come see the fights. You know, he talks in one clip where the guy is interviewing him. He said, how many people do you think will be coming to see you in a fight? He said, I think 100% of them will be coming to see me, but 99% will be coming to see me get knocked out, you know, because they dislike him. But he was the master promoter. He was the original branding, knew how to brand his name, the original social networking guy. I mean, nobody was better than Muhammad Ali at doing those type of things. Here he talks about his. Go ahead, Wayne.
No, and the thing is, you talk about the promotion, and then you have elements like Don King, who came out of nowhere and was able to carve a career based on his relationship with Ali. Now I know there's a lot of back and forth about Don King, some good, some bad. But, you know, had it not been for Muhammad Ali, Don King wouldn't be, you know, where he is today. And and that's it. It's just unfortunate that, you know, some people get caught up in not really reading the fine print or just thinking that the same things would apply to them. I don't know. I don't even want to know. I can't even comment effectively on it because there's been so much speculation about Don. But I remember, you know, interviews at the station. He used to come there from time to time with Sharpton, and you know, the ability to promote just seemed to be more prominent at that particular time as a result of what Muhammad Ali was doing, because a lot of those fight guys were represented by white guys, you know, and Burt Sugar and all them other, you know, cats back in the day, you know. Not to take away from them, but the bottom line is, you know, had it not been for Ali making room for other people to get into it, maybe that still would have been a dividing line color-wise in terms of what you could do to promote talent, you know?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, like you said, that Don King, his career was made through his association pretty much with Muhammad Ali, the short time that Muhammad Ali let him promote a lot of his fights. And it was also, you had mentioned Howard Cosell earlier. I think that, you know, Muhammad Ali, a lot of his image and a lot of who he was connected to Howard Cosell and vice versa. And Howard Cosell was the first one to respect Muhammad Ali and call him by his name that he asked people to call him by. And he wrote a very good an article where he was pro Muhammad Ali and his choice to use that name and to be identified as what he wanted to be identified. And the two of them had such a great chemistry, and they fell into kind of a little rapport they fall into after they had been around each other a lot. It was really great. You know, it was really great to see Muhammad Ali and Don and Howard Cosell work like that. Of course, Howard Cosell being the legendary sportscaster. Mm-hmm. But him and Muhammad Ali, I think Muhammad Ali was one of the people that made his career, and Howard Cosell helped to make Muhammad Ali's career. And so he'll be surely missed. Howard Cosell has been missed, but Muhammad Ali, you know, his appeal to future generations, I think, will continue to remain just as strong because of his swagger and his confidence, which is something that a lot of these young kids now identify with that. You know, a lot of these young
And thank God there's social media and there's YouTube that we could go back and look into seeing, you know. Right after his death, I remembered that Billy Crystal did a tribute to Ali. Oh,
yeah.
It was just amazing just to see that again. And I'm just saying, you know, there's just so much that this man has touched so many people in so many different ways. And thank God he was alive to see most of it, even though he might not have been able to be as responsive as he could be. But even up to a couple of weeks ago, he was condemning Donald Trump for his stand on Islam. So,
yep.
And I heard that he choreographed this whole, he knew at some point he would be leaving us. And just the fact that he had planned his own, you know, departure the way he has. It's stunning, and it says a lot. It has political overtones, you know, and
right.
And I'm sorry that I even mentioned the business of politics at the beginning, because I mean I had just really been taken back by this whole loss, and I think anybody who's lived through that period, no matter how old you were or how young old, didn't make a difference. He did have an impact and did say a lot about, you know, giving pride to folk that basically, it's not to say that we didn't have it, but, you know, not on the level in which, you know, he took it to. And I just think that that's something so commendable.
Yeah, Muhammad Ali, I mean, like you said, Jackie Robinson did what he could with the circumstances that he was in, and he will always go down as being one of our great heroes for Black Americans and for America, period.
Right.
But Muhammad Ali was able to take it to another level, and he spoke up loud and clear and was not shy about making his thoughts known about his people, and that's why we love them so. And like I said, the fact that he joined the Nation of Islam, you know, it wasn't the most – not everybody was agreed with everything that they said, but it was almost like that was our force, our protectors. Our guys were willing to stand up and fight if need be for us. And Muhammad Ali, I think that he helped them raise their profile.
I was just going to say that.
And he was representative of a strong, strong Black man who wasn't going to take anything, and was either going to accept him for who he was or not. But one thing you weren't going to do was disrespect him, you know, and that's what we loved about Muhammad Ali always. The last time when he was at the 96 Olympics, you know, when he lit the torch, I remember sitting in, that was shortly after I moved to Los Angeles, and a bunch of friends and I went out to dinner that night. Kadeem Hardison from A Different World, Darryl Bell from A Different World, Tempest Mezzo from The Cosby Show, a couple other friends of mine, acting friends of mine. And we were sitting in the restaurant watching the opening night of the Olympics in 96. Nobody, like you said, nobody knew that he was going to come out there, that he was supposed to be the final person to light the torch.
Mm.
And when he came in the when he came on, everybody in the restaurant was like, "Oh, Muhammad Ali!" And I remember everybody having a collective holding their breath when it came time for him to light the torch, because you could see him shaking and and everybody. And I know all of us at our table were sitting. You know, we were like, come on, you could do it. We were giving him that energy, and he got it done. And you know, I mean, if you watch just that one clip of footage, even the announcer is like, wow, how great is that? I mean, everybody loves Muhammad Ali. And he became such a loving character once people started to learn who he was, and, you know, he wasn't the Black separatist or wasn't part of that Black separatist movement, and his missions all over the world to try and bring peace. And, you know, there's a hostage, a guy that was recently held in Iran or Iraq that was set free because Muhammad Ali asked them. And so, you know,
I forgot about that. That's true, yeah.
And that's just within the last year or two that this guy was released. And they just had him on the news the other night. So all of these things that are things that Muhammad Ali did, and he affected the world. You know, like you said, he shook up the world. I mean, who else are you going to have a dude in the middle of his fighting career make a movie called The Greatest and play himself. I wanted to see that in the movies.
Well, who could play?
Yeah.
Nobody, I mean, you know, I mean, I wanted to see that in the movies. Muhammad Ali was playing himself about his life story, called The Greatest, playing himself. I was like, wow,
yeah,
he's a bad dude.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and there'd be another. I can't think of anyone who could ever, you know, come behind him and follow that act. You know, it's just there's some people right there, you know, who are just certain. They're designed to live in a certain period before they're called, and you know, he in 74 years he did more than what probably he would have done if he had just had a normal, regular life and lived to see 100. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's just a fitting tribute, and I'm sorry to see him go. I'm sorry to, you know, in one sense, I agree with his daughter about the whole issue of seeing him suffer all these years, and it had to be painful. You know, I mean, to see him so robust, so energetic as a child, and I remember the rope-a-dope. I mean, everybody wanted to do that back in the day. You know, when I was a kid, you know, you play around with your friends in the neighborhood and see if you could copy Ali doing that. But one thing, you know, you pointed out again, Eric, and I really hope at some point I'm going to try to reach Brother Leroy Baylor, who used to be the number three guy at Temple Number 7 in Harlem right after Farrakhan took over, and about 3 years after Malcolm died. And through him, I got to know a few people, and hopefully with the permission of your mother, I would like to have him on here to talk about that whole period, because I think that would be interesting to hear what people have to say about Ali's coming to the Nation of Islam.
Right.
Yeah, I think that would be very interesting, Wayne. If you can arrange that, that would be absolutely fantastic.
It was Malcolm X that brought him to the Nation.
Right.
Malcolm's tutoring in terms of Islam and things like that. So we know how great Malcolm was, regardless of the situation that he was in. I mean, you know, that is and was what it was. You know, we've got about 8 minutes left. Maybe we should talk about just the news about the politics, Ma. We talked about that at the beginning of the show.
Not necessarily, but it's the reality. And I know what we really want to listen. Trump, I think, is history. I hope he's history. And I'm glad to see that, you know, what's her name? Hillary is in the spot that she's in right now. And I really hope Bernie Sanders, you know, and Hillary get together, because that would be even a stronger force. But I can't get over the fact that someone like a Donald Trump was trying to be president of the United States. I just can't get over that. And I hope it never happens again. However, you know, it might. But it's just too incredible to think about. But anyway, so that's all we've got politics right now. We'll resume this next week.
Well, really briefly, do want to say, you know, that Hillary is the presumptive nominee. Clinched it last night, allegedly clinched it, even though Bernie is still holding on with the superdelegates. Last night being the primary in the majority of the states, and one more next week in Washington, D.C., where she looks as though, and they say it takes a couple of weeks, really, for California's results to really be verified. But they're saying that even with the delegates that she took in Jersey, and also some of the delegates that she might get in California, if she wins that, she will have legitimately, based on pledge delegates, won the nomination and won't have to have put up with the superdelegates.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit of history last night that was made, that we need to just say that, you know, Hillary Clinton looks like she's clinched the Democratic nomination. And that it probably will be her and Donald Trump.
Yeah, we're coming to the end of the show. But to get away from politics for a minute, and just to mention this, Barrett Hammon is going to be at New Jersey Performing Arts Center. Wayne, did you know that? You know, Barrett Hammon?
Oh, really? Okay.
You know that he's one of the most influential players.
Yeah,
you know?
He's a good act. Yeah.
Barrett Hammon, yeah. He's a reggae star, and he's very
right.
In the Caribbean community, mainly from Jamaica. And a lot of people, and a lot of, you know, Latin bands. You know, I'm looking here now, you know, and seeing, you know, wow. You know, I wasn't paying that much attention to Blau.
When is Barrett Hammon going to be there?
And I just happened to be looking at their outdoor concerts and the rest of the concerts, and he's going to be there July 9th.
Oh, okay.
Good stuff. Reggae, Jamaica's most influential singers team up to the concert performing hits like Electric Boogie Soul and See You Again and Rock Away. Man, I tell you, that's terrific. So anyway, Wayne.
Yeah.
You talked to Beck lately, by the way. Yeah, we have to get in touch with him again because I know he wants to talk about, you know, education and the colleges because the colleges need help. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be talking about that also, Eric.
Wayne, real briefly, I just wonder if you could let us know your sentiment about the issue that the mayor of New York is having with what is it, claiming that he did that some work was done at his place, or what's the issue with the
I, you know, it's funny. I've been talking around trying to dig up information. I mean, I guess the one thing, and I know, Kay, you've had him on the air from time to time back in the day, the Norman Seabrook indictment and the fact of, you know, commingling. And I mean, it's an indictment. You know, we don't know for sure if there's but it seems like they're going through de Blasio with a fine tooth comb, and you know, I don't want to say where there's smoke there's fire, but it's almost like as if somebody has some inside information that will just go directly to him at some point, and I don't know if it's going to lead to his departure as mayor, but you know, already where there talk about him serving just one term. And, you know, when I think about that and think about, you know, we hadn't had a liberal like that since the days of Dinkins, I just really tend to feel that there may be some subtle racism behind what's going on because, you know, he is now part of a family of color, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's been very outspoken about a lot of issues that people of color would certainly would weigh in on. The fact that he got rid of stop and frisk and it just seems to be working, all these things that are going on, you know, he's doing things for the homeless community. And I can't speak for what it's like in New Jersey, but in New York City alone, it is awful what's going on. And the previous mayor, who was knee-deep in money, lives with it, sleeps with it, you know, he was aware of the problems, but no one was really focusing in on how to anesthetize the situation. He would get developers to come in and spend money, but not even set aside, to my knowledge, a certain amount of that to help out those people who couldn't find apartments and places to live, and it's getting outrageous. So,
I have to tell, before we go, because we're running out of time, but I have to tell people,
You
speak of that which you know because you was the director of the news department, you know, at WLIBBLS, and that was a heavy, you know, load to bear. So you know a lot of these inside news stories and the hot button issues. So people need to take it seriously.
So briefly,
I'm trying to see what I can dig up. Again, I don't want to cast aspersions without knowledge, but, you know, I mean, without factual knowledge about what's going on, but I just find it interesting what's happening, and even the back and forth between him and Cuomo, you know, the mayor, that is, there's something awry, and I guess sooner or later, whatever comes out of the FBI investigation with regard to the improprieties on the part of the police and now Seabrook, you know, it'll be interesting to see how things go.
I was interested to see why a lot of this heat is coming on him, and I think that perhaps you're right in some of your musings about, you know, him being too liberal and things like that. Let it go. We're under a minute, so we just want to say thanks to everybody for tuning in to Kay Thompson Live on the Blog Talk Radio. Our co-host our New York correspondent co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Thanks for calling in.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And thanks for your insight in the New York politics. We're going to get into that a little bit further next week. We want to remind everybody once again that you can listen to the Kay Thompson Live show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, blogtalkradio.com/KayThompsonLive, every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. And you can also listen to the show anytime you want because it's archived. My name is Eric Payne.
And I'm Kay Thompson. And join us every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on Kay Thompson Live.
All right. Thanks.
Good night. Peace. All right.
Yeah, that was good. That was excellent.